Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show. I am super excited because we have another schema episode and it's going to be an absolutely great case. Before we get started with this fall weather, any fun things going on with everyone?
I feel like everybody's excited for pumpkin season, right?
As my partner calls it, spoopy season. So we have some ghosts out in our yard just to, you know, keep the spirit alive.
I do appreciate how everyone just starts very early with decorations in the States, you know, for Halloween, Christmas.
Oh, yeah. I definitely have gotten a holiday catalog or two in the mail already. And I'm like, before Halloween seems a little bit early, but hey, Christmas shopping year round, I guess. I'm the most excited. I love Halloween season because I love scary movies. And I feel like it's the time of the year where I can sometimes convince people who don't enjoy scary movies to watch scary movie. So I'm excited for some good horror flicks coming up over the next few weeks.
Before we go into the case, someone needs to share their favorite Halloween costume that they've been in their life.
I was Bob the Builder one Halloween because my dad is Bob. And so he had a construction hat and I had overalls and it just kind of happened. I was in sixth grade, so maybe a little late for that. Anyone else?
That's awesome.
I would say I was cycled through Power Rangers and Teenage Ninja Turtles, honestly, well into adolescence. That always will have a soft spot in my heart. Yeah.
That's so awesome. What about you, Maddie? Awesome.
Oh my gosh. I think a few years ago, I was in newspaper because there was a dress that just had newspaper print and it was, you know, an easy go-to one. So that might be my Halloween costume for the years to come. What about you, Charmaine?
That's awesome. I'm not really into Halloween.
Oh,
so I really don't dress up.
That's all good. Teach their own.
Yeah, I've never really got into the Halloween. What I love is like the scary movies and also going to one of the theme parks around here has like a lot of mazes and stuff. And they do a really good job. So that is really fun.
Nice. Not a paid promotion. Favorite scary movie you've seen recently?
Ooh, have I seen any scary movies recently? I don't think I have. See, like, scary movies I love watching with a group. I will never watch it on my own.
That's a wise strategy. Never watch scary movies alone.
I have made that mistake and then find myself peeking around the bathroom door when I go to get ready for bed. Not a good move.
Okay. So on that note, I think we have an amazing case. Just imagine you're on an admitting shift and you get paged, and it's a page from the emergency department for admission for a 50-year-old female for severe acute liver injury. You just take a quick look at the labs and shows an AST of 27,000 and an ALT of 4,000, an alkaline phosphatase of 193, and a total bilirubin of 2.7 with an INR of 2.3. So Maddie, when you hear about a patient with acute liver injury, what are some initial thoughts that you're thinking?
I must say, when I see liver enzymes in the thousands, there are some alarms that go off in my head, or maybe I should say some voices from scary movies that are just playing in my head. So Anne-Marie gave us information about liver enzymes, AST and ALT. And she also gave us tests of liver function, including the bilirubin and the INR. And when I see AST or ALT in the thousands, my initial thoughts are to distinguish if the patient has severe acute liver injury or acute liver failure. And this distinction is important because it influences our immediate management. So severe acute liver injury and acute liver failure are on a spectrum of liver injury. And we use these terms specifically for individuals who have no pre-existing liver disease. Now, both severe acute liver injury and acute liver failure have AST or ALT greater than 1,000 and can have signs of coagulopathy with an INR greater than 1.5. But what really distinguishes liver failure from liver injury is the presence of hepatic encephalopathy, which manifests as confusion or asterixis. And encephalopathy indicates that there has been such widespread hepatic necrosis that the liver has lost its ability to clear ammonia, which then crosses the blood-brain barrier and leads to encephalopathy. And as I mentioned, distinguishing acute liver injury from liver failure matters because it influences management. A patient with acute liver failure can progress rapidly, so they should be monitored in the ICU, and you should contact a transplant center to determine if transfer is needed and appropriate. And we also need to act quickly to prevent common causes of death in patients with acute liver failure. And these are things like cerebral edema, which can progress to risk of herniation. It includes sepsis and multi-organ failure. So just to briefly kind of go over how we can mitigate some of those. So cerebral edema happens because when ammonia crosses the blood-brain barrier, its breakdown product is osmotically active. So it draws water into cells, leading to edema, intracranial hypertension, and then subsequently a risk of herniation. So to prevent this, you can give osmotic agents like mannitol or hypertonic saline to reduce the risk of cerebral edema. And then to mitigate the risk of sepsis in these patients, there should be a very low threshold to initiate broad-spectrum antibiotics and get surveillance blood cultures. So to summarize, acute liver failure is distinguished from acute liver injury by the presence of encephalopathy. And in this patient, we see there is acute liver injury with AST and ALT greater than 1,000 with signs of coagulopathy. But at this point, we have not heard any indication of hepatic encephalopathy. So I would label this syndrome at this point as severe acute liver injury. Charmaine, how do you think about the causes of severe acute liver injury?
That was awesome, Maddie. We love a good schema. So let's walk through the severe acute liver injury schema. When I think about severe acute liver injury, I think about two issues, whether it's a plumbing issue or whether it is a hepatic parenchyma issue. So when it comes to the plumbing, three things. Issues with hepatic vein can cause a severe acute liver injury. That could be Bottigliari, that could be heart failure, leading to congestive hepatopathy and then ischemic hepatitis. Issues with hepatic artery, again, ischemic hepatitis, thrombosis, vasospasm can do it. And lastly, issues with the biliary tree, like stones. After thinking about whether it's going to be a plumbing issues, I think about what can happen to the hepatic parenchyma itself. And the most common of those are infections, like especially hepatitis A and B. There are other viruses, HIV, EBV, CMV, HSV, VZV, they all can do it. But the first that I always think of is hepatitis. And then toxins. Tylenol is the one that comes up often. So think about drugs, meds, herbs, sometimes like supplements. So wanting to definitely ask patients about that. And then less likely and less common, but worth remembering are like autoimmune hepatitis, HLH, Wilson's disease that can also do it. Severe acute liver injury, think about whether it's a plumbing issues, issues with hepatic vein, hepatic artery, or the biliary tree, or a hepatic parenchyma issue. We want to think about Bay-Stroud disease, where the most common etiologies, especially here in the States, the most common etiologies are ischemic hepatitis, biliary tree issues, toxins and medications, and viral hepatitis.
Charmaine and Maddie, that was absolutely fire. I love the general framework here. And I think we can start to use that framework and then also some of the clues within the lab work that AMK gave us to start to move our reasoning forward a little bit. Not necessary to say this is definitively what's going on, but take that framework that you articulated for us, Charmaine, and start to say, okay, how can we prioritize some of these different causes? And there's a few things that we can look at when we look at severe acute liver injury enzymes to make some progress on this. One of them has to do with the ratio of AST to ALT. Many of us have learned in our mind that when the AST is higher than the ALT, it increases the probability of alcohol as the cause of someone's underlying liver injury. And that is true. And we may feel compelled to even consider heavily alcohol in this case, because right, alcohol and liver injury seem like they're very, very well associated. But one of the things that I've been grateful to learn from the hepatologist over the years is that while we think about alcohol hepatitis as causing very significant liver damage, it doesn't oftentimes cause very severely elevated liver enzymes. In other words, severe alc help, the degree of liver injury does not correlate with the degree of liver enzyme elevation that we see. And it's actually relatively rare for alcohol to cause acute liver injury to go up into the thousands. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's certainly improbable. And you'll notice in that brilliant framework that Charmaine articulated, right? We didn't hear alcohol as one of the common toxins there. So our brain oftentimes jumps there reflexively because of our type one reasoning, but we can use our slower type two thing and say, wait a second, alcohol, we can actually move that off the table and focus on these other ones here. A couple other things that we can look at here is that base rate of disease that Charmaine gave us is super helpful because it's also the ones that have the highest tendency to cause very, 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 very high liver enzymes like what we see here. Once we get into the thousands, as both Maddie and Charmaine were saying, right, we can start to think about some of these causes. Once we start to get into the 10,000s and even the 20,000s like this, the probability starts to collapse on some of those very common diseases, particularly ischemic disease, as well as stones. And so that won't necessarily guide the exclusion of these other causes, but we may prioritize and focus on evaluating for features that may suggest ischemic disease, stones, and viruses, as well as any new medications or herbal supplements. Those four common ones, ischemia, stones, medications or herbal supplements, and the professional viral hepatitides, have a particular predilection to move the liver enzymes, not just into the thousands, but very well into the thousands like we see here.
Wow, that was awesome. So a little bit more history. The patient reported sudden onset, 10 out of 10, epigastric sharp abdominal pain that began after eating fast food for dinner about an hour before. There was no radiation of the pain, and she had also noted a sense of anorexia and nausea after. She had not noticed fever or chills, vomiting, diarrhea, changes in breathing, or changes in the skin and the eye color, and had also not noted any joint pains or swelling, rashes, and had not had any new medications or supplements or Tylenol use prior to this beginning. She did not have any recent travel. She did travel to Southeast Asia 5 years prior, but did not note any unusual exposures during that trip. She said that she drinks socially, but had not had any alcohol intake in the past 72 hours and denied history of binge drinking. Her past medical history included hypertension, hypertriglyceridemia, type 2 diabetes on insulin, as well as two prior episodes of pancreatitis that were attributed to triglyceride, as well as medications, including empagliflozin, as well as sitagliptin. She was hospitalized 10 days ago for hypotension and lactic acidosis, which quickly resolved with IV fluids. At that time, there was an extensive infectious workup that was negative, the cortisol was normal, and the metformin was stopped with resolution of symptoms. Liver enzymes were checked at that time and were within normal limits. Her medications include amlodipine, atorvastatin, lisinopril, fenofibrate, Lantus, and glimepiride. She was initially tachycardic to the 130s with a blood pressure of 160 over 90s with a respiratory rate of 25. The oxygen saturation was 98% on ambient air. On the exam, it showed an alert female with no jaundice, no conjunctival icterus, no Kaiser-Fleischer rings were seen. The abdomen was distended and mildly tense, with epigastric tenderness to palpation, as well as tenderness in the left upper quadrant. There were also decreased bowel sounds. Murphy's sign was negative. No asterixis was seen. She was tachycardic, but no murmurs were heard, and the lungs were clear to auscultation. No rashes were seen. Okay, Jack, with this information, how are we moving forward on the case? And how do we connect this abdominal pain to the severe acute liver injury that we know is present?
There are a few things that I enjoy and also feel challenged by more than thinking through acute abdominal pain. And I think this is a particularly complex case to reason through for the reasons that you said. We have to explore how the liver injury potentially connects to the abdominal pain. But because acute abdominal pain is such a morbid clinical presentation in and of itself, we have to be open to the possibility that it's not just the liver on the hook, but also potentially other organs or processes within the intra-abdominal space. So rather than anchoring solely on the liver to start off, let's just talk about abdominal pain in general. We can see and explore how the postprandial nature of this abdominal pain moves our thinking forward. And then at the end, we can bring in the acute liver injury as a potential modifier of how we're thinking about the abdominal pain. For a very morbid chief concern like acute abdominal pain, we want to start our diagnostic journey by thinking about some of the life-threatening or very sinister intra-abdominal diseases. And I particularly appreciate the VIPO plus or minus E framework when we can think about this. The V is going to be vascular causes, for example, mesenteric ischemia, myocardial infarction, which can, even though it's a thoracic disease, can sometimes present with abdominal pain. And then also aortic pathology, whether that's aortic dissection or an intra-abdominal aortic aneurysm. The I just stands for itis. So you take any organ in the intra-abdominal space and add itis on the end of it, and it can cause acute abdominal pain, whether that's appendicitis, pancreatitis, cholecystitis, colitis, right? The list goes on and on. And when you're dealing with the itis category, it can be helpful to take a quadrant-based approach. Think about which organs are in which quadrants, but that can only take us so far, right? As individuals' bodies change and shift and evolve, sometimes things hang a little bit differently than we might expect. And so I have seen certainly appendicitis present as epigastric pain. Cholecystitis start off on the left side of the abdomen. So those quadrants are by no means hard lines in the sand, but they can help us direct our attention to thinking about which organs are likely to lie in which space of the body. The P is going to stand for perforation, which could be a complication of many of the other ones or something that develops in and of itself. The O stands for obstruction, whether that's a gastric outlet obstruction or more commonly a small or large bowel obstruction. And then plus or minus E is going to be for ectopic pregnancy in individuals who may be pregnant. So once we think about those general features, right, we'll sort of explore the possibility of the VIPO plus or minus E framework. And we see many of these on the hook here, right? We talked about ischemia, how that could cause severe acute liver injury. And maybe that's also a feature of her abdominal pain too. Certainly hepatitis is on the hook, as well as a number of other different organs. Her exam isn't maybe characteristic of a perforation. We're not seeing frank abdominal tension or very severe rebound and guarding and tenderness throughout the whole abdomen. And then obstruction, nothing's really jumping out there. And then we certainly want to at least consider the possibility of underlying pregnancy or a complication of that, right? 50 is maybe moving into the age where we would see it less frequently, but better to think about it and falsify the hypothesis than forget to think about it at all. But once we move on from that, this abdominal pain has another feature to it, which is that it's postprandial in nature. And that doesn't exonerate any of the things that we've just talked about, but it can help us prioritize a few different underlying processes or structures. We can think about postprandial abdominal pain as being a luminal cause, so something like peptic ulcer disease, a pancreatic cause, right? Pancreatitis or a pancreatic mass. We can think about vascular causes, as we've already explored, and then hepatobiliary causes. And those are just all the structures that are going to be involved in the initial phase of eating. Food hits the lumen and gets peristalsed through the lumen. The vascular structures are going to have some demand on them to be a part of supplying blood for absorption and digestion. The pancreas secretes enzymes, and then the gallbladder secretes bile into the GI tract. So those are going to be the structures that are involved in the postprandial feature. And if we think about, well, gosh, we know that the liver is on the hook, but which other organs could be involved? That postprandial framework is very helpful, right? Potentially, there's ischemia to the liver that could also be leading to some component of ischemia to the bowel, which, thinking about eating as like the stress test for the GI tract, that may be invoking the abdominal pain. The pancreas is certainly potentially on the hook. The stones that we talked about as a cause of severe acute liver injury are oftentimes gallstones that once they make their way through the biliary tree can also gum up and obstruct the pancreas. And then certainly, right, the liver is there and the hepatobiliary system is also close by. So that may also be a key feature here. Where do we go from here, it's very hard to answer the question of acute abdominal pain without a CT scan. And then certainly other labs are going to be helpful, particularly some of these labs to evaluate these intra-abdominal organs, right? A lactate to explore the ischemia hypothesis, potentially a lipase to explore the pancreatitis hypothesis. And then we can think about rechecking the liver enzymes and then potentially moving forward with a CT scan to get more clarity about which organs are involved in addition to the liver here.
Awesome. Well, I have some of that information that you asked for. So the initial CBC showed a WBC count of 9.4 with a neutrophil predominance. The hemoglobin was 14.8 and the platelets were 200 with an MCV of 100. The BUN was 25 and the creatinine was 2.39 from a baseline of 0.7. The sodium was 130. The glucose was 216. The anion gap was 13. And the lipase was 5,300. A lactate was 2.5. And as we talked about before, just a reminder, the AST was 27,000 and the ALT was 4,000. And the bilirubin was 2.7 with a direct bilirubin of 2.1 and an INR of 2.3. A CT with IV contrast was obtained that showed acute interstitial edematous pancreatitis with adjacent duodenitis that was likely reactive. There was no splenic vein thrombosis or pseudoaneurysm seen. There was also subtle hypoattenuating lesion of the body and the tail of the pancreas, which could reflect focal areas of necrosis. Charmaine, with this information, where do we go from here?
Oh, thanks so much, Anne-Marie. I think just to take a step back and do a problem representation. This is a middle-aged woman with a history of diabetes and hypertriglyceridemia and two prior episodes of acute pancreatitis attributed to medication side effect and hypertriglyceridemia, is presenting with acute onset abdominal pain found to have severe liver injury and acute pancreatitis. For me, like the focus is on figuring out the severe liver injury and acute pancreatitis. Yeah, she has AKI and lactic acidosis as well, which most likely just points to the severity of these two conditions. So for me, these two are front and center. And so this is a great opportunity to just quickly review the diagnostic framework for acute pancreatitis. With acute pancreatitis, there are a few common etiologies that we often think about: stones, alcohol, hypertriglyceridemia, say that four times, and then most sometimes it's idiopathic. There are rare etiologies like, you know, such as structural causes, toxic metabolic things like hypercalcemia, infectious etiologies like hepatitis, autoimmune and vascular pathologies. However, most often for me, my first pass is centered around these four etiologies. So one question is, the fact that she's had recurrent pancreatitis changes our differential and our approach. I would say the first pass, still the most common etiology of acute pancreatitis are the causes that cause recurrent pancreatitis: stones, alcohol, and hypertriglyceridemia, especially if it's not well controlled. If those are not at play, I think about three categories. One is structural issues that can lead to obstruction, like a sphincter of OD dysfunction or ampulla water pathology, for example, tumors. Two, autoimmune disease such as IgG4 disease. And then three, whether there's a genetic disposition at play, like in a cystic fibrosis, again, less likely in this patient. That is our approach to kind of thinking about acute pancreatitis. Then the question is, what is the overlap between acute pancreatitis and severe liver injury? Liver and pancreas are neighbors and share plumbing. So any pathology of distal biliary tract can lead to both liver and pancreatic pathology. What I mean specifically is like obstruction of the lumen itself, for example, by stone, by masses, malignancy, or external compression. After considering plumbing issues, then I think of infections such as hepatitis, toxins, or vascular ischemia events. In this patient overall, if we're going to think about base rate of disease, again, I'm thinking about, you know, liver and pancreas being neighbors to each other and sharing plumbings. The most important thing to think about is like whether there is a biliary tree pathology, for example, stones. She's had a CT with IV contrast that didn't really comment on the gallbladder or any stones. However, I would say in general, ultrasound is more sensitive than a CT scan. And then if we do an ultrasound, depending on what they find, if, you know, they didn't see any stones or they didn't see any biliary duct dilation, if this liver enzyme stay persistently elevated or the common bile duct is like a bit dilated in the absence of any concern for cholangitis, then I think it's fair to think about MRCP, making sure we're not dealing with a biliary tree pathology. So that is kind of how I'm putting it together. Maddie, anything else that you would do for the severe liver injury workup?
Yeah, thanks, Charmaine. I love the Venn diagram you illustrated between pancreatitis and severe liver injury. To me, when I'm thinking about the workup for severe liver injury, it's really anchored in the base rate that Charmaine talked about. Let's recall that Charmaine said the top causes of severe acute liver injury include ischemic hepatitis, stones, viral hepatitis, and then drugs or toxins. And when we think of the workup, it's important to note that not every test has the same diagnostic yield. So we really want to focus our workup to evaluate the most common causes of severe liver injury. So the high yield workup includes first taking a very thorough history of the drugs, medications, and supplements that can be hepatotoxic. And you can send a Tylenol level if you're concerned about acetaminophen toxicity. Second is testing for acute viral hepatitis, specifically hepatitis A, B, and C. You can also include testing for HIV, EBV, and CMV. However, EBV and CMV are lower yield for this patient in particular because those viruses more commonly cause severe liver injury in patients who have received a transplant or who are on chemo. Third is imaging, which Charmaine talked about, and this can be in the form of an ultrasound or an MRCP. And imaging is really crucial to assess for bile duct obstruction because, as Charmaine talked about, choledocholithiasis or stones in the biliary tree can cause severe AST and ALT elevations. You can also send tests for autoimmune hepatitis, but I would say this is lower yield and you should send only if there is clinical suspicion. And those tests include an ANA, an anti-smooth muscle antibody, and an IgG level. As we make our way down to the kind of the lowest yield tests, some of the lower yield tests are things like iron testing for hemochromatosis, ceruloplasmin plasmin levels for Wilson's disease. And the reason I say these are lower yield, especially for this patient, is because the time course of those diseases is more chronic rather than this patient who has this severe acute liver injury. So in summary, I would say the high yield workup for severe acute liver injury includes scrutinizing the med list for hepatotoxic medications and supplements, testing for viral hepatitis, and then three, imaging to assess for biliary obstruction. Back to you, Emery. What happened next in the case?
Maddie, I love that approach, and I love thinking about the base rate to inform our workup, but also that taking a complete history and medication and exposure history is part of our workup and has oftentimes more diagnostic yield than some of the tests we do. So for some further testing that was sent, CK level was 166, triglyceride levels were 300, and there was a negative ethanol as well as Tylenol level. An ultrasound was obtained, which showed a contracted gallbladder, but there were some concerns for small cholelithiasis and sludge. There was no signs of secondary acute cholecystitis or choledocholithiasis on the ultrasound, with a common bile duct measuring 0.31 centimeters. She was started on IV fluids as well as pain control and DVT prophylaxis at this point. So I think here we have a lot of different hypotheses in the ways that these could be connected. But Jack, from here, is there any other tests or things that you would be thinking about that could change our management here?
The ever stumping presence of sludge. I think this is such a common dilemma to find ourselves in, right? We've been sort of circling around the possibility of stones. And then when we go to get the imaging to look for it, the stones are not there, but we see this sort of entity of sludge. And so let's just talk a little bit about what sludge is and what that represents. For the longest time, I thought sludge was some separate entity of the biliary tree. Like it was this, like, I don't know if anyone watched Nickelodeon and like seeing slime. I just, for some reason, always had the image of this like green slime, and that's what sludge was. I will give a shout out to Dr. Ansa Huang, who is now a GI attending at the San Francisco VA, but was a fellow when I was an intern. And I will never forget when she shared with me, she was like, Jack, sludge is just tiny, tiny stones coming together. And it blew my mind to understand that in the same way that sand and gravel are all just rocks, sludge and kidney stones are all just sort of small versions of gallstones, right? The sludge just happens to be composed of microlithiasis, right? Very, very small stones that make this almost like wet sand type substance, whereas gallstones are just macrolithiasis or bigger stones. So if we look at the imaging findings through this lens, it's really helpful because what we see is that there's some sludge or microlithiasis left behind, as well as the query that we have had the whole time of whether or not gallstones were the ultimate cause here. And it makes sense that this that gallstones may not be visible when we look in the biliary tree, because we have evidence of them gumming up an important part of the hepatobiliary and pancreatic system, causing possibly pancreatitis and severe acute liver injury. So whatever big stone was there that got stuck at some point is no longer going to be visible on the ultrasound, right? It's made its way through the biliary tree into the common bile duct and ultimately potentially getting stuck somewhere near the ampulla of Vater as it enters into the duodenum. And so seeing these imaging findings to me makes me think, gosh, it seems like there's a stronger and stronger case mounting for gallstone pancreatitis complicated by severe acute liver injury. And as you were alluding to, AMK, that matters because when someone has gallstone pancreatitis, it's an indication for getting a cholecystectomy, right? So we can think about gallstone pancreatitis as a complication of gallstone disease. And if we want to prevent this from happening again, we can remove the source, one of the big sources of those gallstones developing, which is going to be taking out the gallbladder.
I will never forget the image of slime. There was no slime seen on imaging, thankfully. With time in the hospitalization, the AST and ALT downtrended. I mean, downtrended actually fairly quickly, but the bilirubin remained elevated at 4. An MRCP was obtained just because of the concern and wanting to evaluate for cholecystectomy, and did show acute on chronic hemorrhagic pancreatitis, as well as some cholelithiasis, but no signs of cholecystectomy. Some further testing showed negative hepatitis A, B, and C testing, but did indicate hepatitis A and B immunity. There was negative HIV as well as syphilis testing. Blood cultures remained negative. IgG4 levels were within normal limits, and pregnancy test was negative. An LDH was 9,433, and a ferritin was 58,000 with a T saturation of 110%, which I do not even know if physiologic possible. There were normal ceruloplasmin levels, and then EBV, CMV, adenovirus testing was negative, ANA was negative, as well as the anti-smooth muscle antibody. A TTE showed normal left and right-sided heart function, and there were no valvular lesions seen. At this point, as has been discussed, the liver injury was felt to be most likely related to a past gallstone causing pancreatitis and severe liver injury. It's possible that there could have been some ischemic injury, but no hypotension was noted during hospitalization. And with a normal TTE, this was felt to be less likely. There is the elephant in the room, which is that ferritin of 58,000. Whenever I see a ferritin that high, alarm bells go off in my head, the slime pours down. So Maddie, what are we thinking about this ferritin? How do we connect it to what's going on?
Yeah, Anne-Marie, that ferritin is indeed not normal. And I would say this episode is just getting so scary with enzymes that are too high. There's slime. There's voices from scary movies. I'm not sure how much longer I will last. But yes, that ferritin is very high. And there are two key functions I tried to remember about ferritin that can inform how we think about the causes. First is that ferritin, to remind all of us, is the storage protein for iron. And second is that ferritin is an acute phase reactant, which means that the levels will rise in the setting of inflammation. So serum ferritin often tells us what the total body iron stores are, but they can also be independent of iron stores, particularly in the setting of inflammation. So when I think of causes of elevated ferritin, I ask myself, is there concurrent inflammation or not? In the setting of inflammation, such as infections, autoimmune disease, or malignancy, ferritin can be elevated because it is an acute phase reactant. If there is no inflammation, the causes I consider are iron overload, weak from damaged cells, and some rare congenital causes. And a helpful pearl is that the serum transferrin saturation can be really useful in clarifying if the elevated ferritin is due to iron overload or other causes. In most patients, high transferrin saturation with an elevated ferritin would indicate an iron overload syndrome. And this is actually the case with our patient who has both an elevated transferrin saturation and a high ferritin. My prediction is that there are two factors driving the elevated ferritin in this patient. The first is ferritin leak from damaged hepatocytes. So ferritin, as we know, is the storage form of iron in the liver. And so any process that results in hepatocyte necrosis can release the stored iron into circulation, leading to elevated ferritin levels. In fact, in a study that described the conditions associated with serum ferritin higher than 50,000, hepatocellular injury was the second most common cause after renal failure. And the second factor that I think may be contributing to this patient's elevated ferritin is low hepcidin levels. So hepcidin is produced by the liver, and the way I think about its function is essentially as a parole officer for iron. So it prevents iron from leaving enterocytes, from leaving hepatocytes, from macrophages. It just doesn't let it go anywhere. So with hepatocyte damage, like in this patient with severe liver injury, there will be lower hepcidin levels and thus less interference with intestinal absorption of iron and transfer of iron into the plasma. So to summarize, causes of high ferritin include inflammation, leak from damaged hepatocytes, iron excess, or congenital etiologies. In this case, I would recheck the ferritin levels after the acute liver injury has resolved, and I would expect the levels to normalize. Anne-Marie, what ended up happening with this patient?
Maddie, that was such a great summary. And that connection between hepcidin and just like limiting movement is going to be forever in my mind. So with this, I always remember that story. I think Reza told of thinking that a patient had hemochromatosis because they had an elevated TSAT and it was actually alcohol use, which is a mimic. And so a lot of things that can cause liver injury and cause leakage of that can acutely mimic it. So these levels downtrended with time. It was not a clinical syndrome that was felt consistent with hemochromatosis. Time and rechecking once the severe degree of liver injury has resolved is going to really give clarity on the syndrome. You know, unfortunately, this patient had a really tough hospital course. We can talk about the pathology and the pathophysiology, but forget the person that is going through this, and it's scary and interfering with her life. And so in the course of the hospitalization, she developed thrombocytopenia that was felt to be secondary to acute inflammation. There was no signs of HIT or other acute pathology or DIC, and then also developed hypophosphatemia that was really significant with concomitant vitamin D deficiency. But in the setting of all this, developed a pretty significant ileus with cecal dilation up to 11 centimeters with a Ogilvie's type picture. And so a really complicated hospitalization with lots of complications through this. And throughout this time was just worried about getting back to work and what things would look like. Ultimately, thankfully, she improved, was able to get a cholecystectomy prior to leaving the hospital. And by the time she left the hospital, her liver enzymes had almost completely resolved. The thrombocytopenia was improving. She was eating and drinking well. And so I'm just so thankful that in the end, she did well. But it was a quite serious illness. So, you know, I always want to be thinking about how can we do better for our patients. I open this time for reflection, but one thing I was thinking about, and just that you all reminded me as we discussed this, is about remembering to ground ourselves in base rate. With the prior episodes of pancreatitis, you know, I think everyone at that time was, you know, really trying to think about what was going on. And there was a lot of confounding data with some of the medications and the high triglyceride levels. But thinking about how common gallstones are and making sure that you have the best test. So as Charmaine reminded us, that CT is really good for some things, and it's better for cholecystitis, but ultrasound is more sensitive for cholelithiasis, with one study showing ultrasound had a sensitivity of 87% compared to CT only having between 50 and 60%. So really making sure we're getting the right test. Team, did you have any other thoughts on this case?
I don't think I could have summarized it better than you did right there, AMK. I think the reflections on the importance of the base rate of disease, both from, yeah, a probabilistic perspective, but also thinking about how if we stay rooted in epidemiology, we can potentially intervene quicker than we otherwise would. And as a result, prevent some of the downstream hospital stays or downstream complications that she went through over what sounds like a really, really brutal hospital course. And I'm just relieved it turned and went in the direction that it did, as opposed to progressing to something much more serious.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think another thought that I had is sometimes the more extreme the elevations are or abnormalities in the labs are, the more I want to chase them and send every single test. But reminding myself about base rate, about time sometimes, or history being an excellent diagnostic test too, and really being still thoughtful about my approach and the tests I'm sending. Obviously, we do kind of have to adjust our approach to how ill the patient is, how quickly we need an answer. But I think we can still be thoughtful in that space.
Oh, I love that, Anne-Marie. Thank you so much for sharing this case. And yeah, I totally agree. I feel like if you're in a diagnostic train and the station is like a rare disease, it still needs to go through like the common disease and atypical presentation of the common pathologies. So this is such a great reminder of that. So grateful for you. And hey, recording SEMA episodes with you all is always so fun.
Thanks, y'all, so much for tuning in. Wishing everybody a spooky listening to this one. Hopefully, you will not be scared of severe acute liver injury or tumefactive sludge after tuning into this one. But we look forward to seeing you next time. And thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
Oh, we're so nerdy. I love it.
That's a wrap, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time. I just love that someone named it that. They were like, it's sludge. It's just so awesome.
Yeah, who came up with it?
It's great.